arms or his legs, or anywhere, really, save his face. And that would narrow our search down quite a bit. Kreitzler said that given this consideration, he was prepared to narrow things down still further by declaring that it was the killer's eyes that were the location of his deformity. In the remainder of this fourth paragraph, he describes abducting the boy using a highly imperative tone. Does he mention desire? No. He tells us that he must. He must because those are the laws by which his world, disagreeable as it may be, has always functioned. When Kreitzler finished, I speculated. The remark about Giorgio being unsoiled by him, the filth he despises, is actually in him, a part of him. Marcus took my point further. And would be transmitted through the act of sex. So sex is not something he values or enjoys. It's the violence that's his goal. Sarah joined in. Isn't it possible that he isn't even capable of sex, given the kind of background we're supposing that is? Yes, our boy's pretty tender on that subject. Marcus went to the note and read from it. I never fucked him, though I could have. Kreitzler wrote impotence in the center of the board without hesitation. Indeed. The effect would be to magnify his frustration and rage, producing ever more carnage. And that carnage emerges now as our most difficult puzzle. If these mutilations are indeed personal rituals, unconnected to any definite religious theme other than the dates, then regardless of whether he's a priest or a plumber, it becomes all the more important to understand the details, for they will be specific to him. But this letter, I fear, gives us very little help along such lines. We saw little of Kreitzler during the next week or so, and I later learned that he'd spent nearly all of that time in the city's jails in a variety of residential neighborhoods, interviewing men who'd been arrested for domestic violence, as well as the wives and children who'd suffered at their hands. He came into our headquarters only once or twice, saying next to nothing, but collecting notes and data with great, almost desperate determination. Meanwhile, we sent cables and letters to almost every reputable asylum in the country, and gradually answers began to trickle in. Most of these were firmly negative, but a few offered hope, reporting that a man or men of the general physical description that we had given, and characterized by at least some of the mental symptoms we'd noted, had been committed within their walls at some point during the past 15 years. A few institutions even sent copies of case files along, and while none of these ultimately proved of any value, a brief note postmarked Washington, D.C. did create quite a stir one afternoon. On that day, I happened to be watching as Lucius strolled through the room carrying a batch of the asylum letters and case files. He caught sight of something, and suddenly spun on his heels, dropped the pile of papers, and stared at Kreitzler's desk. His eyes went quite wide for a moment, and his forehead almost instantly began to perspire. But as he took out a handkerchief and began to mop the sweat away, his voice remained steady. Doctor, Kreitzler was standing by the door talking with Sarah. This note from the superintendent of St. Elizabeth's. Have you looked at it?
Only once. It didn't seem to offer very much.
Yes, that was what I thought. The description's awfully vague. The reference to some sort of facial tick, for instance, might cover a lot of ground. But, well, it's the postmark, Doctor. Washington. St. Elizabeth's is the federal government's principal asylum for the insane, isn't it? Kreitzler paused for a moment. And then his black eyes jumped in their quick electric way. That's right. But since they never mentioned the man's background, I didn't... He knocked a fist against his forehead. Fool! Kreitzler made a dash for the telephone, and Lucius followed. Given the legal situation in the capital, it would hardly represent an unusual case.
You've a mastery of understatement, Detective Sergeant. There are several such cases every year in the capital.
Sarah was walking toward them, drawn by the excitement.
Lucius, what is it? What struck you?
Lucius slapped at the letter. The postmark. There's a very troublesome little codicil to the Washington laws that deal with insanity and the involuntary commitment of patients to asylums. If the patient hasn't actually been adjudicated insane in the District of Columbia, but is confined to a Washington institution, he can apply for a writ of habeas corpus, and he stands an almost 100% chance of being released.
I still didn't understand.
Why is that so troublesome?
because so many mental patients in that city, especially at St. Elizabeth's, have been sent there from other parts of the country.
Lucius drew a deep breath, his excitement mounting, as Kreitzler attempted to get a telephone line through to Washington. St. Elizabeth's is a receiving hospital for soldiers and sailors who've been judged unfit for military duty, unfit because of mental illness. The slow, drifting way in which Sarah, Marcus, and I had been approaching Lucius and Kreitzler now became something of a stampede. Lucius explained further. It didn't occur to us at first, because there's no mention of the man's background in the letter, only descriptions of his appearance and his symptoms, delusions of persecution and persistent cruelty. But if he did, in fact, see military service and was sent to St. Elizabeth's, well, there's a chance, a slim but real chance, that it's...
Lucius paused, seemingly afraid to say the word.
Him.
The idea seemed a sound one, but our mood of hopefulness was fairly well dashed by Kreitzler's phone call. After being kept waiting for quite a while, he did finally manage to get the superintendent of St. Elizabeth's on the line, but the man treated Laszlo's request for further information with the utmost contempt. Apparently he knew all about the notorious Dr. Kreitzler, and felt the way many asylum superintendents did about my friend. If Kreitzler wanted to rummage through the hospital's records, he could damn well come down to Washington and do so himself. The difficulty was that Kreitzler couldn't just drop everything and shoot off to the Capitol. None of us could, for we were just a couple of days away from Pentecost. And on the night of Pentecost, despite our best efforts, we once more found ourselves gathered around the body of a young immigrant boy. This one found on Bedloe's Island beneath Bartholdi's great statue of Lady Liberty. Roosevelt's eyes were fixed on the body. It's an even worse sight in this place.
But why just exactly this?
Kreitzler held out a hand to the body, and I knew he was speaking of the mutilations. Roosevelt answered,
"The devil himself only knows. I've never seen anything like it, short of a Red Indian."
Laszlo and I both froze, and then spun silently on the man. Our stares must have been fairly intense, for Theodore looked momentarily unnerved.
"Well, what's gotten into you two, if I may make so bold?"
Laszlo took a step forward.
"Would you mind repeating what you just said?"
"I've been accused of many things when I speak, but never mumbling. I believe I was clear."
"Yes, yes, you were. But what exactly did you mean?"
The Isaacsons and Sarah had drawn close, reading something big in the fire that had swept into Laszlo's previously downcast features. Roosevelt continued a little defensively.
"I was simply thinking of the only other violence like this that I've ever come across. It was when I was ranching in the Dakota Badlands. I saw several bodies of white men who'd been killed by Indians as a warning to other settlers. The corpses were cut up terribly, much like this one, in an effort, I suppose, to terrify the rest of us."
"Yes. Excellent.
Sarah, you and Lucius go back to number 808 and get in touch with the War Department in Washington. Find out if they keep any records of soldiers dismissed for mental illness. Tell them we are only interested in soldiers who have served in the Army of the West."
"I know a few people at war, if it would be any help."
"It would indeed.
Sarah, take the names, then on your way." Later, as Laszlo and I headed back to number 808 ourselves, excitement still filled him.
"Do you see, Moore? Do you see? He's been out there, our man. He's witnessed it. He defines such behavior as horrible and dirty, dirty as a Red Indian. Yet he also considers himself full of filth. He combats those feelings with anger and violence. But when he kills, he only sinks further down, down to a level he despises even more, down to the lowest, most animal behavior he can imagine, modeled on that of an Indian, but, in his mind, even more Indian than an Indian."
"He's been on the frontier, then?"
"He must have been, either as a child or as a soldier. Hopefully we can clear that up through our Washington inquiries. I tell you, John, we may have blundered last night, but today we are closer."
Closer we may have been, but we were not, sadly, as close as Laszlo hoped. Sarah and Lucius, we learned on returning to our headquarters, had been unable to get anywhere with the War Department, despite Theodore's contacts. All information relating to soldiers hospitalized or dismissed from service for reasons of mental distress were confidential and could not be discussed by telephone. Kreitzler planned to make the trip to Washington himself. However, when I told him that from my days on the Washington Post, I still knew a good number of journalists and government workers in that city, including one especially good contact at the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Indian Affairs, he deemed it advisable for me to come along. He would press the War Department and St. Elizabeth's while I did research at the Bureau. During the next few days, I saw very little of Washington outside of my little corner of the Bureau's dusty records room. As will happen during extended periods of windowless research, reality soon began to lose its hold on my mind, and the horrifying descriptions I pored over of massacres, murders, and reprisals took on a vividness that they would not have had if I'd been reading them, say, in one of the city's parks. Most of the accounts were of acts of vengeance on the part of the Indians, which, while severe, seemed at least understandable when measured against the abominable treachery of the white soldiers and the agents of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. One morning, toward noon, my friend and contact, Hobart Weaver, stopped by to see if I had any interest in lunch. "Plenty. Pick me up in an hour. I should make it through the 1892 cases by then." "Fine." He started to move away from the desk, then touched his jacket pocket and seemed to remember something. "Oh, John, I meant to ask you. This search of yours is definitely confined to the frontier states and territories. Is that right?"
"That's right. Why?"
He pulled a folded paper from his pocket.
"Well, just an odd story. I found it after you left last night."
He tossed the piece of paper on my desk.
"But it won't work. Happened in New York State."
"Chops?"
I picked up the paper and began reading it.
"What?"
"For lunch. Chops. There's a splendid new place on the hill. Good beer, too."
"Fine." Hobart sped away to catch a pretty young archivist who just passed my desk. Chuckling quietly at the fellow's hopelessness, I leaned back in my chair to study the document he'd left me. It related the curious story of a minister named Victor Dury and his wife, who in 1880 had been found murdered in their very modest home outside New Paltz, New York. The bodies had been, what the document called, most foully and savagely torn to bits. Reverend Dury had formerly been a missionary in the West, where he'd apparently made enemies among the Indian tribes. In fact, the constabulary of New Paltz had decided that the murders were an act of revenge on the part of several embittered Indians who'd been sent by their chief for that very purpose. This bit of detective work had been the result of a note from the assassins found on the scene that explained the killings and stated that the dead couple's teenaged son was being taken back to live among the Indians as one of their own. It was quite a grim little tale, one that would have been of obvious use to us had its setting been further west. I put the paper aside, but in a few minutes picked it up again, wondering if there wasn't at least a chance that we were wrong about our killer's geographic background. Finally deciding to discuss the matter with Kreitzler, I tucked the document away in my pocket. That night, as we sat down to dinner in the hotel dining room, I offered it to him as he set to work half-heartedly on a bowl of crab bisque. His eyes suddenly went very wide, and he set his spoon down slowly as he finished reading the document. Then he looked at me. "Where did you get this?"
"Hobart. You found it last night. Why?"
His hands moving quickly, Kreitzler snatched some folded papers from his inside pocket. Quickly flattening them on the table, he thrust the pile across to me.
"Notice anything?"
It took one or two seconds, but I did. At the top of the first sheet of paper, which was yet another form from St. Elizabeth's Hospital, there was a space marked Place of Birth. In that space had been scribbled the words, New Paltz, New York.
"This is the man they originally wrote to us about?"
Kreitzler nodded eagerly.
"I've kept the file with me. I dislike hunches generally, but I couldn't get away from this one. There are so many particulars that match the poor upbringing in a strictly religious household and the one sibling, a brother. Remember Sarah's idea about his being from a small family because the mother disliked childbearing?
Kreitzler...
And that tantalizing reference to a facial tic, which even in his hospital record is never explained in any greater detail than an intermittent and violent contraction of the ocular and facial muscles, no explanation as to why? Kreitzler. And then there's the pronounced emphasis on sadism in the admitting alienist's report, along with the particulars of one incident that caused his commitment. Kreitzler, will you please shut up and let me look at this?"
Yes, of course. I have a powerful feeling about this, Moore.
I began to carefully go over the first page of the hospital file. Corporal John Beecham, admitted to St. Elizabeth's Hospital in May of 1886, had at that time stated that he'd been born in New Paltz, the small town just west of the Hudson River, and some 65 miles north of New York, that had been the scene of the Dury murders. The specific date of birth cited was November 19, 1865. His parents were identified only as deceased, and he had one brother, 8 years older than himself. I reached over and grabbed the Interior Department document that told of the murdered minister and his wife. Those crimes had been committed in 1880, and the victims were listed as having a teenage son who'd been kidnapped by Indians. A second and older son, Adam Dury, was apparently at his home just outside Newton, Massachusetts, at the time of the murders. I grabbed another sheet of the hospital file and scanned the notes penned by John Beecham's admitting alienist in an effort to find the specific cause of the corporal's confinement. Despite the sloppiness of the doctor's handwriting, I soon had it. Patient was part of force requested by Governor of Illinois to quell disturbances arising from strikes in Chicago area beginning May 1st, Haymarket riots, etc. During May 5th, action against strikers North Chicago, soldiers ordered to open fire. Patient subsequently found stabbing corpse of one dead striker, had gouged eyes out with enormous knife. Lieutenant M. discovered patient in flagrante. Patient claims M. always had it in for him and was constantly watching him. M. ordered patient relieved of duty. Regimental surgeon pronounced him unfit for service. Then followed the comments on sadism and delusions of persecution that Kreitzler had already told me about. One of the final assessments, written just before Beecham's release, contained the following paragraph. Patient has applied for writ of habeas corpus and continues to claim nothing wrong or criminal in behavior. Says society must have laws and men to enforce them. Father was evidently a very godly man who emphasized importance of rules and punishment of violators.
Well, Moore, what do you make of it all?
The timing matches, along with the location. Kreitzler clapped his hands together.
I never would have dreamed of such a possibility. Who could have? Kidnapped by Indians. It's almost absurd. We need more particulars.
I can telephone Sarah and put her on to a friend of mine at the Times who will let her into the morgue.
It's a morgue?
Where back issues are kept. She could find the story. It must have made the New York papers.
Yes. Yes, it would have.
Kreitzler lifted his wine glass with a smile.
Well, Moore, new hope.
The next evening, a young bellboy in a brass-buttoned red uniform entered the hotel bar, calling out my name. Jumping up, I went to the lad, who told me that I was wanted by the desk clerk. Kreitzler followed as I dashed out front. The clerk handed me his telephone, and as soon as I took it up, I heard Sarah's very excited voice.
John, are you there?
Yes, Sarah, go ahead. Sit down. We may be on to something.
I don't want to sit down. What is it?
I found the story of the Dury murders in the Times. There were featured articles for about a week and smaller notices after that. Just about anything you'd want to know about the family was in them.
Wait, tell it to Kreitzler so he can take notes.
Laszlo put his small notebook on the registration desk, annoying the clerk, and then lifted the telephone's earpiece. This was the story he heard, which I followed from his scribblings. The Reverend Victor Dury's father had been a Huguenot who'd left France in the early part of the last century to avoid religious persecution, the Huguenots being Protestants, and most of their countrymen Catholics. He'd gone to Switzerland, but the family's fortunes had not flourished there. His oldest son, Victor, a Reformed Church minister, had decided to try his luck in America. Arriving at mid-century, Dury had made his way to New Paltz, a town that had become home to scores of French Huguenot immigrants. Here, Dury had started a small evangelical movement, funded by the citizens of the town, and within a year he'd moved with his wife and young son to Minnesota, with the intention of spreading the Protestant faith among the Sioux there, said Indians, not yet having been pushed west to the Dakotas. Dury didn't make much of a missionary. He was harsh and overbearing, and his vivid descriptions of the wrath that God would bring down on unbelievers and transgressors did little to impress the Sioux with the advantages of a Christian life. The group in New Paltz that had been financing his work had been on the verge of recalling him when the Great Sioux Uprising of 1862, one of the most savage Indian-white conflicts in history, broke out. During that event, the Dury family only narrowly escaped the grisly fate that befell many of their fellow whites in Minnesota. but the experience, nonetheless, provided the Reverend with an idea that he thought would ensure continued backing for his mission. Laying his hands on a daguerreotype camera, he went around taking photographs of massacred whites. And when he returned to New Paltz in 1864, he became famous, indeed infamous, for showing these pictures to large collections of the town's better-off citizens. It was a blatant attempt to frighten those staid, fat people into providing more funds, but it backfired. The pictures of slain and mutilated corpses were so horrifying, and Dury's behavior during the presentation so feverish, that the Reverend's sanity began to be questioned. He became something of a social pariah, unable to find a religious posting. Ultimately, he was reduced to working as a caretaker in a Reformed Dutch church. The unexpected arrival of a second son in 1865 only made financial matters worse, and the family was eventually forced to move to a tiny house outside town. Knowing Dury's troubled history and behavior as well as they did, and no more informed about Indian habits than the average white community in the eastern United States, most of the citizens of New Paltz had never questioned the idea that Dury's murder in 1880 was prompted by the bitterness he'd engendered among the Sioux in Minnesota during his stay among them nearly two decades earlier. All the same, there was some scattered talk of bad relations between the Durys and their oldest son, Adam, who'd moved away to become a farmer in Massachusetts many years before the killings. Rumors that Adam might have snuck west into New York State and done his parents in, for what precise reason no one would publicly say, began to spread, but were never treated as anything other than gossip by the police. And while no trace of the younger Dury boy, Japheth, had ever been found, the idea of his being kidnapped to become an Indian brave fit in thoroughly with what New Paltz's citizens had been taught to expect from the savages who inhabited the western territories. So ended the tale of the Dury family. Sarah's research, however, had not been limited to that story. Recalling that she'd known a few people in New Paltz during her youth, she'd made some social calls after leaving the Times, just to see if any of those old acquaintances knew anything about the murders. The one such person she found at home did not. But Sarah had gone on to ask for a general description of everyday life in New Paltz, and in so doing had stumbled on a rather electrifying fact. That New Paltz sits at the foot of the Shawangunk Mountains, a range well known for its large, forbidding rock formations. Almost afraid of the answer she might get, Sarah had next asked whether or not any citizens of the town enjoyed climbing those formations as a pastime. Oh, yes, she'd been told. It was quite a popular sport, especially among those residents who had most recently arrived from Europe. Both Kreitzler and I were fairly stunned by this last item and needed time to absorb both it and the rest of the tale. Laszlo rung off, following which we returned to the hotel bar to mull things over.
Well, Moore,
Kreitzler spoke in a somewhat awed tone as we ordered a fresh round of iced cocktails.
What do you make of it? I myself have a host of questions. The answers to be found, I suspect, only in Newton, Massachusetts.
To judge by the dilapidated state of his barns, fences, and wagons, as well as the absence of any assistants or particularly healthy-looking animals, Adam Dury had not made much of a go of his little dairy cattle enterprise. Few people live in closer proximity to life's grimmer realities than do poor farmers, and the atmosphere of such places is inevitably sobering. Kreitzler's and my excitement at actually laying eyes on the man we traveled a fairly long way to find was immediately tempered by appreciation of his circumstances, and after getting down from the Surrey and telling our driver to wait, we approached him slowly and carefully. He continued to struggle with the left foreleg of an old horse.
Excuse me, Mr. Dury?
Yes.
Mr. Adam Dury?
You must know that if you come to see me. Dury dropped the horse's leg with a grunt. He stood up, rising to a height of well over 6 feet. He finally turned around, revealing a head whose skin was so tightly drawn that it appeared little more than a flesh-colored skull. The almond-shaped eyes were of a lifeless blue tint. His arms were powerfully developed, and the fingers of his hands as he wiped them on his worn overall seemed remarkably long and thick. He took our measures with a squinting grimace that was neither friendly nor hostile.
Well, what can I do for you two gentlemen?
I moved directly, and if I may say so gracefully, into the bit of subterfuge that Laszlo and I had worked out on the Boston train. This is Dr. Laszlo Kreitzler, and my name is John Schuyler Moore. I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I found my billfold and revealed some professional identification. A police reporter, actually. My editors have assigned me to investigate some of the more, well, to come to the point, some of the more outstanding unsolved cases of recent decades. You've come to ask me about my parents? Indeed. All the features of Dury's face seemed to shift and resettle in a kind of wave, as if a shudder of pain had rippled through him. When he spoke again, the tone of distrust had vanished from his voice, to be replaced only by resignation and sorrow. I've got no desire to talk about it. He began to move away. Knowing New Englanders as well as I did, however, I'd anticipated this reaction. There would, of course, be a fee, a consulting fee, nothing excessive, mind you, say $100. Aware that such a sum would, in fact, mean a great deal to a man in his straits, I was not surprised to see Dury's almond eyes jump.
$100? For talking?
That's right, sir. I produced the sum from my billfold. Thinking it over just a bit more, Dury finally took the money. Then he turned to his horse, swatted its rump, and sent it off to graze on a few patches of grass that grew near the edge of the yard. I've got work to do, and I can't ignore it for the sake of ghost stories. He took heavy steps away from us through the sea of manure. Kreitzler and I followed him. Inside the barn, the stench grew stronger, softened only by the sweet aroma of hay, a store of which was visible in the loft above us. Dury went directly over to a very old manure spreader, the axle of which was propped up on a pile of rocks. He hissed in disgust and began to fuss with the end of the axle. All right, ask your questions. We've read the newspaper accounts that appeared at the time. Newspaper accounts. I suppose you've also read, then, that the fools suspected me for a time. Oh, we've read that there was gossip, but the police said they never believed it. Not much they didn't. Only enough to send two of their men all the way over here to harass my wife and myself for 3 days. While the police accounts were very vague and confused, maybe you could make things a little clearer for us. My parents were hard people, Mr. Moore. They had to be, to make the trip to this country and survive the life they chose for themselves. But while I can say that now, such explanations are quite beyond a small boy who only hears a cold voice and only feels a thick strap. A blast of passionate language had seemed about to escape the man, but he'd held it down with obvious effort.
Then you were beaten.
I wasn't referring to myself, Mr. Moore. Though God knows neither my father nor my mother ever shrank from punishing me when I misbehaved. But that was not what caused our estrangement. He looked out a small, filthy window for a moment. I had a brother, Japheth. Yes, we read about him. Tragic. You have our sympathy.
Sympathy?
I suppose. But I'll tell you this, Mr. Moore. Whatever those savages did to him was no more tragic than what he endured at the hands of his own parents.
He suffered cruelties?
Dury shrugged. Some might not call them such, but I did, and still do. Oh, he was a strange lad in some respects, and the ways in which my parents reacted to his behavior might have seemed natural to an outsider. But it wasn't. No, sir. There was the devil in it all somewhere. You see, well, my mother could scarcely abide my father's slightest touch, much less his attempts to build a family. After we returned to New Paltz from Minnesota, things between them deteriorated completely. They rarely spoke in the years after that, and never touched, not that I can recall. Except once. Just once.
He paused, and I urged him to continue.
Japheth?
Dury nodded slowly.
I'd taken to sleeping outdoors when it was warm enough, near the mountains. My father had learned the sport of mountaineering in Switzerland from his own father, and the Schauengunks were an ideal spot to keep his hand in, as well as to pass the techniques on to me.
Though I was never very good at it, I always went along with him because they were happier times, away from the house and that woman. But during the coldest months, there was no avoiding the indoors, not unless I wanted to die of exposure. And I remember one February night when my father, he may have been drinking, though he rarely did. But sober or no, he began to finally rebel against my mother's inhuman behavior. He spoke of the duties of a wife and the needs of a husband, and he began to grab at her. Well, my mother screamed in protest, of course, and told him he was acting like the savages we'd left behind in Minnesota. But my father wouldn't be stopped that night. And despite the cold, I fled the house through a window and slept in an old barn that belonged to a neighbor of ours. Even from that distance, I could hear my mother's cries and sobs. Dury seemed to lose all awareness of his present surroundings and spoke in a detached, almost lifeless voice. And I wish I could say that those sounds horrified me. But they didn't. In fact, I distinctly remember urging my father on. His presence of mind returned, and somewhat embarrassed, he picked up a hammer and resumed work. No doubt I've shocked you, gentlemen. If so, I apologize. I tried to reassure him so that he would continue. No, no, you're only giving us a better understanding of the background. We quite understand that. Tell us, what sort of a boy was your brother? You said odd. Odd in what way? In what way was he not? I suppose you couldn't expect much more from a child born out of anger and unwanted by both his parents. To my mother, he was a symbol of my father's savagery and lust. And to my father, much as he wanted more children, Japheth was always a symbol of his degradation, of that terrible night when desire made an animal of him. I tried to give Japheth what help I could, but by the time he was old enough for us to be real friends, I had been sent to work on a nearby farm and saw little of him. On Sundays, I'd try to spend time with him and show him that there was much he could still enjoy about life, whatever happened at home. I taught him how to climb the mountains, and we spent whole days and nights up there. But in the end, I don't believe that anyone could have counteracted my mother's influence. Was she violent? No. I believed then, and I still believe now, that my mother's ways were far more devious. Dury took out a pouch of tobacco and a pipe. I suppose, in a way, that I was luckier than Japheth, only because my mother's feelings toward me had always taken the form of thorough indifference. But Japheth, it didn't seem enough for her to merely deprive him of love. She took issue with his every action, his every move, however insignificant. Even when he was an infant, even before he had any awareness and control over himself, she'd badger him about everything he did. Kreitzler leaned forward, offering a match.
What do you mean by everything, Mr. Dury?
Well, you're a medical man, doctor. I think you can guess. Smoking for a few seconds to get a good coal going in his pipe, Dury finally shook his head and grunted angrily.
The cruel bitch.
Hard words, I know, for a man to assign to his own dead mother, but if you could have seen her, gentlemen, at him, always at him. And when he complained or cried or went into a rage over it, she'd say things so despicable that I would have thought them beyond even her. That he wasn't her son, that he was the child of Red Indians, dirty, man-eating savages who'd left him in a bundle at our door. The poor little fellow half believed it, too. With savage, terrifying suddenness, Adam Dury screamed incomprehensibly and threw a shovel against the rear wall of the barn. The chickens in the adjacent coop sent up a flurry of frightened clucks and feathers, and hearing them, Dury wrenched the pipe from his mouth and attempted to regain control over himself. Kreitzler and I made no move, though I know my own eyes had gone quite wide with shock.
I think we had all best be honest with each other. Gentlemen, do you imagine that simply because I'm a farmer, I'm also an idiot? I know what it is you're here to find out.
I was about to offer protests, but Kreitzler touched my arm.
Mr. Dury has been exceptionally forthright with us, Moore. I believe we owe him the same courtesy.
Dury nodded, and his breathing became something like regular. Yes, Mr. Dury, we believe there is every chance that your brother murdered your parents.
A pitiable sound, half sob and half gasp, got out of our host. "And is alive?"
Kreitzler nodded slowly, and Dury held his arms helplessly. "But why should it matter now? So long ago. It's over, done. If my brother is alive, he's never contacted me. Why should it matter?"
"Then you suspected it yourself?"
Kreitzler produced a flask of whiskey and held it out to Dury, who nodded and took a drink.
"How, Mr. Dury? How did you know?"
I felt a twinge of real sympathy when a tear appeared on Dury's cheek. "When Japheth was, oh, 9 or 10, we spent a few days up in the Shawangunks, hunting and trapping small game, squirrel, possum, coons and such. I taught him to shoot, but he wasn't much for it. A born trapper, Japheth was. He'd spend a whole day searching out an animal's lair or nest and then wait for hours, alone in the dark, to spring his scheme. It was a talent. But one day we were hunting separately. I'd gone to trail some bobcat tracks I'd spotted, and as I came back to camp, I heard a strange, terrible scream. A wail, high-pitched and faint, but awful. As I came into camp, I caught a glimpse of Japheth. He'd trapped himself a possum, and he was cutting the thing to pieces while it was still alive. I ran up and put a bullet in the poor creature's brain and took my brother aside. He had an evil sort of light in his eyes, but after I'd hollered at him for a while, he began to cry and seemed truly sorry. I thought it was a lone incident, the kind of thing a boy might do if he knew no better and wouldn't do again once he'd been told. Dury began to poke at his pipe, which had gone out. Kreitzler offered another match.
"But it wasn't."
"No. It happened several times over the next few years. Several times that I knew of, that is. He never bothered the big animals, the cattle or horses on the farms around us. It was always the small creatures that seemed to bring it out in him. I kept trying to put a stop to it, and then..."
Dury stared at the ground, seemingly unwilling to go on. Kreitzler, however, kept after him gently.
"And then something worse happened?"
Dury nodded. "But I didn't hold him responsible, Doctor, and I think you'll agree that I was right not to." One of his hands became a fist, and he slammed it into his thigh.
"But my mother, damn her, just took it as another example of Japheth's devilish behavior. Claimed he brought it on himself, as if any boy would."
"I'm afraid you'll have to explain, Mr. Dury." He nodded quickly, then took a final sip of whiskey before handing the flask back to Kreitzler. "Yes, yes, I'm sorry. Let me see. This would have been during the summer of... Hell, it was just before I moved away, the summer of 75 it must have been. Japheth was 11. At the farm where I'd been working, they'd recently hired a new man. He was just a few years older than me. A charming character, to all appearances. Seemed to have quite a way with children. Well, we got to be friendly, and eventually I invited him along on a hunting trip. He took a great interest in Japheth, and my brother took a real liking to him. So much so that the fellow came along on a few more outings. Japheth and he would go off trapping together while I hunted larger game. I'd explained to this thing that I thought was a man, that Japheth was to be discouraged from tormenting any animals they might catch. The fellow seemed to understand the situation thoroughly. I trusted him, you see, to look after my brother. And he betrayed that trust, in the worst way a man can. I found Japheth in our camp one evening, half naked and weeping, bleeding from the... well, bleeding. The fiend I'd left him with was gone. We never saw him again.
This fellow, the farmhand, can you recall his name?
Indeed I can, Doctor. Guilt has burned it into my memory. Beecham. George Beecham. The name struck me harder than had any piece of information that had been revealed thus far, and turned much of the triumphant exhilaration that I'd been feeling back into confusion.
I see. Well, we must leave soon, Mr. Dury. Let me say before we go that your brother suffered a great deal, and I suspect that his suffering has gone on in the years since your parents were killed, if indeed he is still alive.
It is not our place to judge him or to profit from his misery. The tight skin on Dury's face grew tighter as he strained to hold back strong emotions. I have just one or two more questions before we go, if you wouldn't mind.
If I have the answers, they're yours, Doctor.
Kreisler inclined his head appreciatively. Your father. Many Reformed ministers place little emphasis on church holidays, but I get the feeling he did otherwise.
Indeed. Holidays were among the only pleasant occasions in our house, but I can't see how...
Kreisler's black eyes were positively alight as he held up a hand. It's a small point, I know, but I was curious.
As we walked out to the carriage and climbed up, Laszlo appeared to remember something. Oh, and another detail. Your brother, Japheth, at what point did he develop the difficulty in his face?
His spasms? Well, he always had them, to the best of my recollection. Perhaps not when he was an infant, but soon after that, and for the rest of his... Well, for as long as I knew him, at any rate.
They were constant?
Yes.
Except, of course, in the mountains, when he was trapping. Those eyes of his were as calm as a pond then.
I wasn't at all sure how many more revelations I could bear without bursting, but Kreisler took it all in stride.
A sad, but in many ways a remarkable boy. Well, goodbye, Mr. Dury, and thank you.
We finally pulled away from the little farm.
Good God. Tell me, Kreisler. Tell me we've got a solution.
Kreisler allowed himself to smile.
We've got the pieces of one, John. Yes, we have most of it.
Driver, you may take us directly to the Back Bay station. There is a 6:05 train to New York. We must be on it.
So began 20 of the most extraordinary and difficult days of my life. We briefed our colleagues when we returned to New York, and Sarah promptly opened the calendar and held the book out, pointing to one page in particular. I looked down to see the notation for Sunday, June 21st, just 3 weeks away, the Feast of St. John the Baptist. My eyes jumped open. I made a connection that, though perhaps a long shot, was nonetheless apparent.
St. John the Baptist. Water. John Beecham. Of course. He became the tormentor and the purifier.
The next step was to follow his path from St. Elizabeth's Hospital. After some highly speculative debate, Lucius held up a finger.
If you will please give me a minute, thank you very much. The way to find out what he's doing with his life now is to follow the trail of what makes him feel secure, not the trail of his nightmares. He's hunting and killing on the rooftops, and his victims are children, all of which suggests that having control over situations is the most vital thing in his life. We know about the hunting and trapping, but the rooftops. As of 1886, he hadn't spent much, if any, time in a major city, yet now he's thoroughly mastered them. That kind of familiarity would take some time to develop.
Sarah nodded slowly.
I'm beginning to see your point, Lucius. He leaves St. Elizabeth's and wants to go to a place where he can be fairly anonymous. New York is a likely choice. But when he gets here, he finds that he's completely unfamiliar with how life works on the streets. The crowds, the noise, the agitation, it's all very strange, perhaps even intimidating. Then he discovers the rooftops. It's a completely different world up there, quieter, slower, fewer people. It's much more what he's used to. And he finds out that there's a lot of jobs that require spending a great deal of time on those rooftops. He barely needs to come back down to the streets at all. Except at night, when the city's much less crowded and he can familiarize himself with it at his own pace.
Marcus got up and crossed over to the large map of Manhattan Island, pointing at the pins that had been stuck into the thing to mark abduction and murder sites.
None of his activities have taken place above 14th Street, which suggests that he's most familiar with the Lower East Side and Greenwich Village. He probably lives, as well as works, in one of the two areas. Our theory that he doesn't have much money fits in with that. So, we can confine our search to people who do business in those neighborhoods.
Lucius agreed. If we're right, if the killer did start out his life as Japheth Dury and later became John Beecham, then he wouldn't apply for just any kind of job. Given his character and background, some things would be far more attractive than others.
With a rather strange pang of dread and excitement,
I realized that I knew this man well enough to say that he wouldn't have sought a job that would have required him to either curry favor with immigrant tenement dwellers or hawk the shoddy wares of manufacturers and store managers, whom he would almost certainly consider less intelligent than himself. The odds are he's involved with mission or charity work of some kind. Now, that would be easy for him. He'd have gotten all the religious grounding and terminology from his parents. Fine, but even if we narrow it down that far, we'll have a hard time checking them all by June 21st. It's completely impractical. Impractical it may have been, but there was no way around it. We spent the rest of that day amassing a list of all the charitable and religious organizations that did business on the Lower East Side in Greenwich Village, then divided the list up into regional groups. While Kreitzler went off to follow his own investigations, Sarah, the Isaacsons, and I each took one of the sublistings and headed out the next morning. I received a somewhat less than warm reception from the organizations on my list. By the time I came lumbering into number 808 Broadway several days later, I was so sick of the fatuous hypocrites who made up New York's charitable community that I was spewing a steady stream of rather violent curses. Having thought our headquarters empty when I came in, I spun round in shock when I heard Sarah's voice.
Well, that's lovely language, John, though I must say it fairly well describes my mood at this point.
She was smoking a cigarette and staring alternately at the map of Manhattan and the chalkboard.
We're on the wrong track. She threw the stub of her cigarette out the open window. Has it occurred to you, John, that none of these organizations seem to know very much about the people they're trying to help? It doesn't match.
Match what?
Him, Beecham. Look at what he does. He insinuates himself into these boys' lives and convinces them to trust him. He goes through exactly the motions required to establish friendship, as if he knows what they need. These charity people have none of that quality.
Sarah, be realistic. What kind of door-to-door organization that deals with large numbers of people takes the time to find out detailed personal information? And then I froze. Really froze. The simple fact of the matter I remembered in a numbing rush was that there was one organization that did take the time to find out just the kind of personal information that Sarah was describing. An organization whose headquarters I'd passed every day for the past week without ever making a connection. And an organization whose hundreds of employees were well known for traveling neighborhood rooftops. I grabbed Sarah's hands.
What time is it?
Nearly 6. Why?
Someone may still be there. Come on.
I pulled Sarah toward the door without further explanation. She bellowed questions and protest, but I refused to answer any of them as we descended to the street in the elevator and then dashed down Broadway to 8th Street. Wheeling left, I led Sarah to number 135. Pulling at the door to a staircase that led up to the building's second and third floors, I breathed a sigh of relief on finding that it was still open. I turned back to Sarah to find her staring with a smile at a small brass plaque that was screwed to the wall just next to the doorway. United States Bureau of Census. Charles H. Murray, Superintendent. We entered a world of files. Both of the floors occupied by the Census Bureau were lined with wooden filing cabinets that ran right up to the ceiling and blocked every window. Mobile ladders ran on tracks around the walls of each floor's 4 rooms. The first occupied desk that Sarah and I found was on the 3rd floor. At it sat a fairly young man who wore a banker's visor and an inexpensive but particularly well-pressed suit, the jacket of which was slung over his plain, straight-back chair. Cuff protectors covered the lower portions of the man's white, starched shirt sleeves, as the thin, sallow hands protruding from them attacked a folder of forms. I approached the desk slowly.
"Excuse me."
The man looked up sourly.
"Official hours are over."
I recognized an incorrigible bureaucrat when I saw one.
Of course, had this been official business, I would have come at a more appropriate hour.
The man eyed me up and down, then glanced at Sarah.
"Well?"
"We're with the press. The Times, actually. I wonder if Mr. Murray is still in."
"Mr. Murray never leaves the office before 6:30.
"Ah, then he's still here.
He may not want to see you.
The members of the press weren't exactly helpful last time around. Even the Times made ridiculous allegations. After all, we can't be responsible for every bribe and falsified report, can we?"
"Naturally not. We're in a bit of a hurry, however, so if you could just point me toward Mr. Murray..."
"I'm Charles Murray." Sarah and I glanced at each other quickly, and then I let out a perhaps impolitic sigh, realizing what we were up against with this fellow.
Well, Mr. Murray, I wonder if you might be able to check your employment records for the name of a man we've been trying to find. Murray eyed me from under the visor. Identification? I handed him some, and he leveled it just a few inches from his face, as if he were checking a piece of counterfeit currency. He gave it back to me. The man we're looking for is called John Beecham. He's just over 6 feet tall, with a bit of a facial tick. A bit of one? If he's got a bit of a facial tick, Mr. Moore, I wouldn't like to see an entire one. My voice quavered a bit. Then you know Beecham? I did know him. He doesn't work for you? He did. I dismissed him. Last December. Always a very proper, respectable person, which was why I found it remarkable. Murray tapped a long, bony finger on his chair for a few seconds as he examined first me and then Sarah. Finally, he stood up, went to one of the rolling ladders, and sent it down its track to the far end of the room with a sudden, hard shove. He followed and then mounted the ladder. Pulling out one wooden drawer near the ceiling, he ran through it for a file. Beecham was hired in the spring of 1890. He applied for a job as an enumerator. I beg your pardon? Murray came back down the ladder with a large envelope in one hand. An enumerator. The men who do the actual counting and interviewing for the census. Then I promoted him from enumerator to office clerk and kept him on for another 5 years. Opening the envelope, Murray pulled out a folded paper and handed it to me. Beecham's application? Trying to disguise my eagerness, I scanned the document as Murray summarized it. But he was quite qualified, just the sort of man we look for, actually. University education, unmarried, good references, all powerful recommendations. And so they would have been, I thought, as I studied the document, had they been even remotely legitimate. The information before my eyes represented a litany of lies and an impressive set of forgeries. You'll see his address at the head of the form. At the time I dismissed him, he was still living in the same rooms. At the top of the sheet was written, in a hand that I recognized from the note we'd studied weeks earlier, 23 Bank Street. That was near the center of Greenwich Village. Yes. Yes, I see. Well, thank you, Mr. Murray. Sarah and I reached Bank Street, and a typical series of Greenwich Village blocks opened up before us, lined with trees and townhouses, a picture of quaint monotony. As we passed by each residence, we could see into the relatively low-standing parlors of the comfortable middle-class families who inhabited the neighborhood. Number 23 Bank Street was only a block and a half from Greenwich Avenue, but as we covered that distance, Sarah's and my hopes had time to rise high nonetheless. When we reached the building, however, disappointment crashed down hard. In one corner of the parlor window was a small, very tasteful sign, Room to Let. Sarah and I exchanged sobered looks, then made our way up the steps of the building to the narrow front door. There was a small brass bell handle, and I pulled it. Silently, Sarah and I stood and waited for several minutes. Then we finally heard shuffling footsteps and an old woman's voice. No, no, no. Get away. Go on now. It was difficult to tell whether or not the order was being directed at us, but when several bolts on the door were noisily thrown, I began to suspect that it was not. The door finally opened, and we were faced by a small, white-haired crone in a faded blue dress of a style dating back to the 70s. Her eyes were lively, though they did not bespeak a particularly clear mind. She was about to say something to us when a small orange cat appeared at her feet. She kicked the creature lightly back into the house. No, I said. These people have nothing to say to you. Any of you. At that point, I became aware of some rather loud mewing coming from inside. By my reckoning, the work of at least half a dozen cats. The woman looked up at me brightly. Yes? Did you want to inquire about the room? The question put me at a momentary loss. Fortunately, Sarah stepped into the breach. The room, ma'am? Not precisely. Rather about its former occupant. Mr. Beecham has, I believe, moved. Mr. Beecham, yes, very polite, very prompt, and never drank. Not a favorite of the cats, of course. Not much of a man for animals at all, really, but... Did he leave a forwarding address by any chance? He couldn't. He had no idea where he was going. He thought perhaps Mexico or South America. He took everything he had with him. He said there were opportunities for men of initiative there. Do you think we might have a look at the room? Certainly. She ushered us inside, the cats following us down the hall. The room that Beecham had rented was on the third floor, which, climbing at the old woman's pace, seemed to take an eternity to reach.
When was it that Mr. Beecham left?
Oh, I remember the day very well. It was a week before Christmas. It was about the time that little Jib disappeared.
A Jib? A cat?
Yes. Just disappeared. Never a word. They have their own affairs to attend to. Cats.
By the time we reached Beecham's room, all eight of the cats had already collected around the door and were mewing away.
The first thing that struck me was that the cats didn't follow us in. As soon as the door opened, their mewing stopped, and then they sat at the threshold, looking momentarily concerned, before they shot off down the stairs. With their departure, I turned to survey the chamber, and quickly caught a trace of something in the air, the smell of decay. A dead mouse, or some such, I decided, fixing my attention on the room. I needn't have bothered. It was a spare chamber with little furniture. Sarah and I searched for a few moments, but found nothing. Then we turned to go back downstairs. Sarah and our hostess had already reached the staircase and were heading down when I caught sight of something just inside the door of Beecham's room, a few small stains on the striped wallpaper. They were of a brownish hue, and in a pattern that indicated that whatever the substance was, and it could easily have been blood, it had hit the wall in a hard splatter. Following the path of the stain, I arrived at the bed and pulled the mattress up to have a look. The stench hit me, suddenly and hard, and I caught sight of a small skeleton. A furry hide was stretched over the bones, though in some spots the hide had rotted away, revealing the dried remains of inner organs. Old rotting string was wound around the four legs of the skeleton at the feet, and next to the rear legs lay several sections of jointed bone, a tail, I realized, that had been cut into pieces. The creature's skull, barely covered by a few small patches of skin and fur, lay some 8 inches from the rest of the skeleton. I finally let go of the mattress, then jumped out into the hall and took out a handkerchief, dabbing at my face. Resisting the urge to vomit, I took a few deep breaths, then headed down the stairs. When I reached the front door of the house, where Sarah was already saying goodbye, I thanked our hostess quickly and then stepped out into the cloudless night, the air of which seemed especially clean, given what I had been breathing inside. After seeing that all the cats were safely in the door, Sarah caught up with me on the street. "John, you've gone pale. What is it?" She grabbed my arm. "You found something up there. What was it?"
"Jib."
"Jib? The cat? What in the world are you talking about?"
"Now, let me put it this way. Regardless of what anyone may say, cats do not just disappear."
Sarah and I got back to number 808 Broadway just a few minutes ahead of the Isaacsons. In a flurry, we told the detective sergeants of our adventures that evening. There were a few minutes of silence, then Lucia spoke up in a grimly determined voice. "We've got to stay with what got us here, follow his confident, aggressive side. Let's assume that he's been able to find another job that gives him what he wants, use of the rooftops, and a way to move among the tenement population without having to try to help or appeal to them. Any ideas?" After some discussion, we narrowed the possibilities down to two basic areas, bill collecting and process serving. Both were secular pursuits that not only would have kept Beecham on the rooftops, front doors often being barred to such unwanted characters, but would also have provided him with a certain sense of power and control. At the same time, such jobs would have given him continued access to personal information concerning a broad range of people, as well as a rationale for approaching them in their homes. Once again, tedious drudgery ate up hours without producing results. Thursday afternoon found me back at our headquarters, finished with a list of agencies I'd been assigned to cover, and at a loss as to what I should do next. Alone and staring out of the windows of number 808 toward the Hudson River, I was consumed by that familiar sense of dread which said that we weren't going to be ready by Sunday night, the feast of St. John the Baptist. I was jolted back to the business at hand by the sound of the telephone. Picking it up, I heard Sarah's voice. "John, we were right. He was working for a bill collector until he was fired 2 weeks ago. Anyway, I've got a new address, 155 Baxter Street. I'll meet you there. Now get moving." Before I could reply, she had rung off. I found my jacket and threw it on, then wrote a note for the others. I was about to go out the door when the telephone rang again. It was Joseph. the young boy Marcus and I had met at the Golden Rule Pleasure Club.
"Mr. Moore, is that you?"
"Joseph? What's going on?"
"Oh, well, nothing except that... Are you sure about the things you told me? About the man you're looking for, I mean?"
"As sure as I can be about anything in this business.